In this episode of Flying Smarter, I start by looking at the types of aircraft with an upper deck. Then, for the main segment, air traffic controller Andy Watson joins me to talk about how air traffic control works. Welcome to episode 39 of Flying Smarter, the podcast that explores the fascinating world of air travel to help you become a smarter and savvier traveler. Let's get started. What are the planes with a second level? Most planes look like a long tube with a single row of windows, but you may have seen large jumbo jets with an upper deck. Now, there are two types of passenger planes with an upper deck. If you see a large aircraft with a full upper deck, this is an Airbus A380. It's the world's largest passenger jet, and episode 26 of Flying Smarter talks about this magnificent aircraft. If you see a plane that has an upper deck, but only on the front part of the plane, this is a Boeing 747. The Boeing 747, nicknamed the Queen of the Skies, is an iconic aircraft that's no longer in production, but the newer variants are still in service with some airlines today. I'll post photos of these two types of aircraft on the Flying Smarter social media accounts over the next 2 weeks to help you identify them and see what they look like. Did you know that you can enjoy hot springs at Tokyo's Haneda Airport? Japan is famous for its hot springs, known as onsen, and a recent addition to the airport allows travelers and visitors to experience them right at the airport. Haneda Airport Garden is a large new commercial complex with restaurants, retail outlets, and two hotels. It's attached to the airport's Terminal 3, and it opened a few months ago. The Hotel Villa Fontaine Grand is located in the complex and is home to a 24-hour spa that's open to both hotel guests and non-hotel guests. It has four bathing zones featuring natural spring water drawn from a local source. Andy Watson is an air traffic controller, pilot, author, and public speaker. He's worked as an air traffic control specialist and frontline manager at several Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, facilities in places such as Cleveland, Chicago, Charleston, and Washington, D.C. He's also served as a subject matter expert for the FAA's Air Traffic Safety Oversight Branch at FAA headquarters in Washington, D.C., and he's the author of the book, The Pilot's Guide to Air Traffic Control, which helps pilots and passengers gain a better understanding of everything that ATC does to keep the flying public safe. I'm so glad to have Andy here with me today. Andy, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Before we get started today, though, I am still a full-time air traffic controller, and because of that, I am required to say that the opinions given during this presentation are that of Andy Watson International LLC and not necessarily the same opinions as the Federal Aviation Administration. Now, with that, Andrew, I would like to say I think it's really cool the podcast that you've put together to help teach people about aviation when they're not really affiliated with it. In fact, one of the stories that my wife loves to tell people and laugh about is when we first started dating. I actually offered to take her flying for our fourth date, and we were going to fly out of the Medina County Airport, which is south of Cleveland a little bit, just a small little airport, only the little four-seat type aircraft flying out of there. And we were going to fly down to Columbus, grab some dinner, and then fly back. Well, her and I meet up before we go, and we drive to the airport together. I park by the one building that's there, and we walk into the office, and I get the book for the airplane, which has the keys in it. And then we walk out the door on the opposite side of the building, which opens up to the ramp of the airport. So we're walking out towards the airplane, and then later my wife tells me that that is the point that she got super bummed. And the reason why is because she thought she could have wore more cute shoes, because she had only flown with the airlines up to that point. So she thought we were going into the big Cleveland airport and was going to have to go through security with TSA to get to our aircraft. So she wore sandals that she could slip on and off easily, but she could have wore better shoes for our date. So
it's interesting you say that. So as you know as well, I also fly the little four-seater Cessnas as well. And I the first few times I didn't know as well how to brief my passengers, but now I make it very clear to them where we're going, what we're doing, what the plane looks like, so that they have a better idea.
Yep. I learned the same lesson after that flight too. So
Anyway, so Andy, we're here to talk about air traffic control, and I'm super glad to have an air traffic controller on. It's an area that I think a lot of passengers don't know very much about, so I'm really glad to have you here. You're the first one here to talk about air traffic control on the show, so I'm really glad that you've joined me today.
You bet. I'm happy to be here.
Let's start with going through people's journey. As a passenger sitting in the plane, you really don't get exposed to that this whole side of your air travel experience, even though it's a essential part for what your pilots do and how the system keeps you safe. How many controllers do pilots speak to throughout a flight? What are kind of the different people that interact with your pilot?
Well, to be honest with you, the big question or the big answer to that is it all depends. Basically, what people don't realize is there's really kind of three different components of the air traffic system. The first one is you go to the airport and you see the air traffic control tower, and that tower has big windows for a reason because the controllers that are up there, if you want to think about it, those controllers are looking out the window and controlling the pavement of the airport. That's essentially what they do. It's a little bit more than that, but not really. So they're the ones that give the pilots clearance to taxi from the gate to the runway. They're clear to take off and they're clear to land. That is actually the smallest component of the system. Basically, imagine that you get on your airplane, you taxi out, you take off. Once you're about a few hundred feet above the ground, the tower is going to switch you to departure control, or what we here in the United States call the terminal radar approach control, or the TRACON. And the TRACON, everywhere is different. It's all based upon the complexity of the airport and the airspace design and all that. But in general, most of the TRACONs own the airspace from the ground up to 10 or 12,000 feet and approximately a 30-mile radius. And what they do is after you take off, you're back in your airplane, they take you from wherever you're at on the runway or after you do a few hundred feet above the runway, and they put you out certain departure gates and to get you on your way. And vice versa, there's different arrival gates that come in, and they take you from the arrival gate and then line you up for the runway. And then once you're lined up for it, they switch you to the tower to get the clearance to land. So that is the TRACON. Well, if you think about it, a 30-mile radius and 10 or 12,000 feet of altitude is nothing in the grand scheme of things. So then we have what here in the States we call the Air Route Traffic Control Center, which we refer to as the ARTC, because that's the abbreviation, but pilots call it the center. So the centers do everything between the airports and at high altitudes. So that's really where a lot of the busy traffic ends up being, other than for the truly busy airports per se. So like your New York's, your Washington DC's, stuff like that. Those are very complex, very busy airports. Where I grew up down by Columbus, Ohio, the Columbus Airport, I mean, they have a TRACON and stuff there, but they don't have as many controllers working there as what the bigger airports have, of course, and they have smaller airspace to work. So basically, you start with the tower, you end up with the TRACON, you talk to the center, and then in reverse, once you get to your destination, you'll be talking to the TRACON again, and then the tower to get your taxi clearance back to the gate. So that's kind of the three components of it. Within each component, there are a few different controllers you may talk to, and at the smaller airports, they may be combined up and be the same person, where the pilot will actually talk to clearance delivery as the first one, where they actually will get their route of flight from where they depart clear to their destination, because if their radio fails on them, that is still the plan that they're going to fly. That way, both air traffic control and the pilots know exactly what they're going to do, even if their radio is not working. So they get that clearance with them. Then they talk to ground for the taxi clearance. Then they talk to what we call local control to get the takeoff and landing clearances. But the pilots call that the tower controller. So all those can actually be combined up and be the same person working all that. And that's the same as even in the centers, like on the midnight shifts. Oftentimes we combine all six or seven sectors into just one position in the area and one controller works it. And then when it starts getting busier, we split different sectors out, and we can actually have three controllers work in one sector. So I'd truly be guessing if I told you exactly how many controllers a pilot would be talking to whenever they're departing out on a flight between their departure airport and their arrival airport. But if you are on the East Coast, for example, you're going to be talking to a lot of them. They may only be talking to controllers in the center for a minute to 3 minutes at a time before they get switched. So it really just all depends.
And all these people, I know you said that there's big windows on the tower for obvious reasons. So the tower controllers and the ground controllers presumably work at the towers. Where does everybody else work?
Well, the TRACONs, most of those are actually in the building at the base of the towers. Some of your larger ones, you have, well, like here in Washington, D.C., you have Potomac TRACON. That's a building out by itself. Same for like New York TRACON and Chicago TRACON. The centers, though, they are also in buildings by themselves. They're just these big old buildings that were built back in the 50s and 60s here in the States. Buildings with no windows, government buildings with a guard shack and a fence around it. People have no clue what it is.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I was super surprised to find out about. I kind of just assumed everyone was sitting at the control tower, but I realized that the bulk, almost the bulk of, or at least a good portion of air traffic controllers don't actually sit in any sort of tower with any sort of window.
Correct.
Now, I think one of the things that brings people anxiety when they're flying is in when the case of something goes wrong in emergencies and that type of thing. So obviously pilots play a big role when there's an emergency of an air with an aircraft, but air traffic control has a big significant role too. Can you tell me a bit about what happens between pilots and air traffic controllers in the case of an emergency?
Sure. Yeah, the way the law is set up is pilots must adhere to air traffic and control instructions, unless for whatever reason they're not able to. However, the minute that a pilot declares an emergency, they are the ones calling the shots, and we as controllers are there to help them get whatever they need so that they can have a safe outcome. So, for example, a couple years ago now, I was working the super highs in my area, which is flight level 340 and above, so 34,000 feet and above, because we call everything 18,000 feet above flight levels. I had a few airplanes, but I wasn't too busy. I had an aircraft that was going from the New York area down to, I think, Houston, and it was a 737. They were level at flight level 360. They check on, everything's normal, and then about 5 6 minutes later, all of a sudden they key up and say, yes, center. We're declaring an emergency and for a passenger's personal electronic device that's smoking, and they need to divert to the Dulles Airport. Well, where they were at, Dulles was pretty much directly behind them by about 50 miles. So I tell them, I say, yep, Roger, you're clear to Dulles Airport via direct. I did not specify a direction because I didn't have any traffic in their immediate vicinity. And I also wasn't exactly sure what was the shortest turn for them. So I just left that up to them. And they come back and say, okay, they're starting to left turn direct Dulles. And then at that point, I start working with the other controllers because that part of my sector is fairly narrow. So their U-turn is going to encroach in the sector beside me in their airspace. So I do what's called a point out because no airplane is allowed into a sector without either a point out or a handoff, because essentially that every aircraft has to have permission to gain access to that sector. So that's how we do it. Otherwise, we turn people out and all that kind of stuff. Now, obviously, with an emergency, they're going through no matter what. It's more of a heads up of, hey, move anybody you need to. This guy's coming through, right? So I work that out. I call the sectors below us. I work out a descent down to flight level 280, so I get that going for him, and then I go back and start asking the pilot some of the information that we always try to get, and such as how many people are on board, how much fuel do you have, what was the nature of emergency again? It was a smoking electronic device. That's what they came back because he wasn't. It was kind of garbled when he said it the first time. I wasn't exactly sure, but my highest priority was to get them diverted to their destination before I clarified what that was. So I don't know if it was a laptop, a cell phone, an iPad, or even a wireless pair of headphones. And all of those have lithium ion batteries in them, and all of them can just spontaneously start to smoke and catch on fire. Not sure what it was, but either way, so we get them worked out that way. And then we end up, getting them to send it even lower and then hand it off to approach control. And they ended up making it all the way in to Dulles. They landed. They did have fire and rescue meet them on the runway. They inspected the outside of the aircraft, make sure that it was fine, and then they taxied to the gate and got everybody off the aircraft. Now, in the meantime, the cabin crew, so the flight attendants in the back, what they did is they actually got a fireproof bag and put that passenger's personal electronic device in it, and then put it in the sink in the lavatory because the sinks on that aircraft are metal. So it was still emitting some smoke and fumes from it. So they were still trying to get everybody get it ventilated as best they could. But the cabin crew was able to contain the issue. So there's a pointer for your audience out there of if you have anything with a battery in it, doesn't matter what it is, take it in your carry-on. Don't put it in your suitcase to go underneath the aircraft because at least up top, the flight crew can do something about it. But that's basically one of the emergencies that I've worked that, again, the flight crew's in complete control at that point. They tell us what they need and we just make it happen.
Yeah, it's almost a situation where the roles of who's calling the shots get reversed, right? I mean, normally, air traffic control is the one calling the shots and giving the instructions until there's an emergency, and then the pilots kind of take control and ask for what they want. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, still, whenever we give a clearance, it's still up to the pilot to accept that clearance in normal situations. If it's something they can't do, they need to just come back and tell us, and when we come up with plan B. But at the end of the day, the minute that they accept that, they must do it according to the law. But yes, in an emergency situation, that pilot in command is the utmost authority. And at that point, our role changes to make sure that we move everybody out of their way and do whatever we can to assist them to remedy that emergency.
And now you mentioned there that this is all part of the law. And I think one of the things that is so fascinating about the world of air travel is that there's so many pilots out there, whatever it is, tens, hundreds of thousands around the world. There's, again, the same thing, tens, hundreds of thousands of air traffic controllers, whatever it is out there. What do we have in place that allows everyone to work together, whether it be from the East Coast to the West Coast of the US to the US to halfway around the world? What do we have to ensure that everyone is able to talk to each other and that the system all works?
Well, I guess I should correct myself when I say the law, because it's technically a regulation. So that it is a splitting a hair type of type of difference there. But most of the major countries follow ICAO. It's the International Civil Aeronautic Organization. It's actually based out of Canada there as their headquarters. And basically, they've all agreed by treaties to follow the set of rules that gets put in place. One of the things is you're allowed to talk in English in anywhere you're at, right? Now, it doesn't mean that the language barrier is not going to be significant, but those basic things, that basic verbiage that is commonly used in aviation is going to be understood, and they're going to be able to tell the pilots in English what they need. So that's one way. Of course, in the United States, we all follow the same rule book within our country. That is compliant within the ICAO framework. But it's just the same thing over and over again. And the cool thing is, I know Europe had it before we did here in the States, but the FAA is very, it takes a long time for the FAA to roll out new technology. However, when they roll it out, it's been tested so thoroughly that generally it works very well. And there is a system called CPDLC, which is essentially allows us to text message clearances to the pilots
Oh,
in the
wow.
flight deck. And that's been used for the oceanic stuff for a little while, is what I've been told. I'm not positive on it. And over in Europe, so that takes the language barrier right out of it because they're just sending a coded message that is whatever it needs to be. We started using that just as COVID started hitting here at Washington Center. I think we're the third facility in the States to get it, and it's a nice system. I have to admit, it saves time. The only downfall to it is because I'm not talking as much on frequency. The pilots don't think I'm as busy as I sometimes am because I'm up blinking clearances and I'm not talking, so they think that we're slower than we are and start asking questions that may not be as relevant as what they could be. But that's the only downside to it. Overall, it really helps with missed readbacks and stuff like that because If we uplink them a frequency to go to, it's automatically there. They're not saying it the wrong way, and we have to correct and all that kind of stuff. So overall, the system is set up to allow pilots to go anywhere in the world and get by with the knowledge that they have locally.
That's amazing. I actually had never heard of that system. It's really cool stuff in the works with technology. Anyway, so I know you've been a controller for a while. I think you've worked for around 15 years. So you've had a lot of time to see the different roles that you've worked in, the different places that you've been to. I'm curious to see what you think some of the key challenges for air traffic controllers, either broadly or today, are.
Well, the things that make our lives miserable as controllers, to be perfectly honest, is bad weather. In good weather, we have all the routes set up. You have your routes are set up for the overflights. You have the routes that are set up for the inbound aircraft going into the airports, and then vice versa. You have the departure routes coming out, and they're all separate because when you have climbing and descending aircraft, you need them separated. That way, they can climb and descend because otherwise, you have to step them up and down underneath each other. So when the weather is good, everybody's separated. Yes, it can get busy, and yes, we work a lot of airplanes here, but so it can still be somewhat stressful, I guess you could say. However, what makes our lives miserable is when there's thunderstorms, bad weather, because all those routes are just thrown out the window. Yeah, they are issued the routes, but those pilots don't want to fly through a thunderstorm. I mean, airplanes crash because of thunderstorms. So they'll get going and then they'll need a deviation to the right. And we'll have to tie them back into their route up ahead. So deviation right, of course, direct to Baltimore when able or whatever it is. And what makes it real challenging is we'll have the first five airplanes that will they'll all want to deviate to the right, but then the sixth airplane, because they're all looking at their own onboard radar in the jets and stuff, and they may see something that they don't like going right and they want to go left. Well, our job as controllers is to make sure that everybody remains separated. That's first and foremost. And when you have multiple lines trying to do the same thing, you got to use altitude to make sure that that works. You have to do a couple different things just to ensure separation. But that's when things get interesting because they may not be staying in your own sector. You may have to do a point out, like I already explained earlier, where they're going to deviate in somebody else's sector. There may be traffic there, so I can only let them deviate up to 15 degrees to the right, then direct without doing something else. And that's when it gets challenging. I remember one day I was working the super highs again. It was actually a couple of years ago, and there was basically a huge line, a big line of thunderstorms that was coming through. It went from Canada clear and wrapped clear out and around back down to Mexico, and there was like one hole between the line that was about 20 to 25 miles wide. So everybody that was all the overflights and all the departures that were heading southwestbound to like Florida and Texas and Louisiana, and then all the departures out of the DC area that was climbing up, they all wanted to deviate through that hole. So I'm working and we're able to get them up to the altitudes. And when you're headed westbound, those are even altitudes. When you're heading eastbound, those you're supposed to be flying at an odd altitude. And that helps keep everybody clear with each other. So anyway, I'm getting all these departures out and overflights. They're all deviating left, heading. They're all trying to go southwestbound. So they're deviating left and then trying to hit that hole and then get back on their course from that. So we got them stacked up going through this hole from like 22,000 feet clear up to 40,000 feet for the airliners. And then there's a couple business jets in there that were able to get up above that at 43,000 type stuff. And all the even altitudes are used up. We're even using some of the odd altitudes with people going southwestbound, just to get them all through. And then Indianapolis calls because they have an F-18 fighter jet that's trying to get back to Norfolk, and they're requesting to stay at high altitude to get until they're past the weather. A very common request, and especially with the fighter jets. I mean, we love those guys because they can do whatever we need them to do, right? So the only problem is those old aircraft, they're not certified for what's called RVSM, which it basically allows from 29,000 feet and above, it allows aircraft to be separated by 1,000 feet instead of the old way we used to do it of 2,000 feet. Well, if they don't have the equipment, and one of the few exceptions is military aircraft, if they don't have that, we have to provide the 2,000 feet separation. So this guy was, I think, at 37,000 feet, wanting to go through the same hole, opposite direction as everybody else. So, and I got them stacked up 34, 36, 38, and 40. And basically every 8 to 10 miles, I got them like that. I mean, it's just a ton of airplanes. And so he checks on my frequency, and I say, and I actually ask him, I say, are you able to, I don't know how high this thunderstorm goes. Are you able to get above it? And then we can just let you dive down on the other side of it so that you can make a normal landing. He said, yeah, we can't get up that high. I said, okay, well, unfortunately, I may have to put you in a holding pattern until we get a break in the traffic, because I can't let you go through there when I, with the westbound altitudes 1,000 feet above and below you. I essentially have to lose two of my altitudes for the westbound traffic to allow you to go eastbound through it, if that makes sense. So he said, okay, well, let me take a look again. And then at that point, instead of deviating right towards that hole, he actually decided to go left and try to find a better spot north of my sector to do it. So he deviated left. I called the controller that works that sector, let them know what's going on. As soon as they checked on, he actually climbed up even higher and did exactly as I initially said, but it must not have been as high north of my sector, because he still deviated probably a good 40, 50 miles north of where I was at. And then he came back down and came cut across. So that's just one glimpse of how crazy thunderstorms can actually get. There's a lot of coordination behind the scenes, which pilots don't even realize that we do. We talk to the other controllers for those point outs or anything weird, such as that F-18. And there's also pilots always talking on the line, requesting their deviations, and it's a lot more chatter on the frequency than what it is in normal times. So that is when it is the most complex for us, per se.
It really almost sounds like you're solving a giant puzzle that's three dimensions, and there's people talking to you at the same time, and it gets more and more with more and more dimensions to it all, eh?
Somebody described it way back when. I don't know if this is common or not, if it just was this one guy, but basically we play three-dimensional chess is what we do. So this thunderstorm that I was talking about was positioned about 60 to 70 miles south of the airports in Washington, D.C. So the weather in D.C. was absolutely beautiful at that point in time. However, there were a lot of delays because of the weather, and I know there was a lot of passengers that didn't understand why they were stuck on the ground and wasn't allowed to take off because of the weather when they look outside and it looks absolutely perfect out. So I know that that tends to be a issue, a question among people. And it's the reason why is because you just heard how complex it gets for us at the center. And yeah, they could let them go, but then we're going to have four times the number of airplanes trying to get through that same hole. So a lot of times there are ground stops and other things put into place, or even different routes where you have to fly well out of the way to get to where you're trying to go for that reason, because what they're trying to do is to make it less complex so that it's manageable for the controllers to actually deal with the traffic.
Andy Watson is an air traffic controller with over 15 years of experience. He's worked at several FAA air traffic control facilities throughout the eastern U.S. and has served as a subject matter expert for the FAA's Air Traffic Safety Oversight Branch at FAA headquarters in Washington, D.C. He's also a pilot and a real estate investor and is the author of the book, The Pilot's Guide to Air Traffic Control. His book offers a rare glimpse into the hidden world of air traffic control, offering hundreds of pages of real-life stories, and is designed for everyone from the airline passenger all the way to the professional pilot. You can learn more about Andy and his book at atcandy.com, and I'll have a link to that in the episode description. Well, thank you again, Andy, for being here. I certainly learned a lot, and I think our listeners will have too, and I'm glad that you were able to come share your knowledge and your experience. I really appreciate it.
You bet. I was happy to be here.
That brings us to the end of this episode of Flying Smarter. Please take a minute and follow us on social media, where you'll find things like podcast updates and sneak peeks. Flying Smarter is on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn at Flying Smarter, and on Twitter at Flying_Smarter. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you again soon.